Previously on Flying the Line, incumbent Hank Duffy and first vice president Tom Ashwood angle for position in the 1986 ALPA presidential elections.
This podcast is brought to you by the Airline Pilots Association. ALPA supports its pilots through a variety of resources, including DART, the Data Action Report Program. DART gives pilots one location to ask any question of their pilot group leaders and experts, and provides reporting with trackable, sortable data for their MEC to use. If your pilot group uses DART, you can find it in the ALPA app or at dart.alpa.org. Throw us a DART today.
Welcome to the Flying the Line podcast, a look into the past of the Airline Pilots Association, a bridge from the book Flying the Line, Volume 2 by George E. Hopkins. Chapter 18, Lorenzo's Last Gamble, The Origins of the Eastern Strike, Part 1. By 1987, the little copper box had remained beneath the steps of ALPA's old Chicago headquarters at 55th and Cicero, adjacent to Midway Airport, for 36 years. When Dave Behnke placed it there during the building's dedication in 1951, the artifacts in the time capsule already belonged to an era that was fading fast, as was Behnke himself. The first ALPA president recalled consigning the copper box to wet cement, which would partially crush it and damage some of the items, including a collection of photos, membership lists, and documents. Behnke had been increasingly concerned with ALPA's fate and complained that younger pilots didn't appreciate the struggles he and the 24 key men who helped establish the union had endured. Behnke would be dead by 1953, and ALPA, the entity he had brought to life, would teeter on the verge of collapse, partly because of the building where he had buried his time capsule. Behnke was clearly having indications of limited mortality. He didn't like modern aviation, already so alien to the world of wooden wings he had known, so he retreated into the past. He saw ALPA's Chicago office as a monument to his leadership. Consequently, Behnke lavished time and money on his dream building, insisting that it be built to aircraft specifications. He spent endless hours sidewalk supervising its construction when he should have been taking care of ALPA's business. In 1969, ALPA moved to Washington, D.C., where most of its real business had always taken place. The only reason for ALPA's home office having been in Chicago was that it was Behnke's home. Midway Airport itself went into a long eclipse following the opening of O'Hare, and the ALPA building finally wound up in the possession of a trucking company. Everybody forgot about the little copper box beneath the steps, unmarked now even by the brass plaque emblazoned with ALPA's motto, "Schedule with Safety," which somebody had scavenged. Ironically, the time capsule finally saw the light of day on December 10, 1987, largely because of deregulation. The pilots of Midway Airlines, at the time a promising new entrant carrier and inspired by the fight United's pilots waged in 1985, had recently organized and won an ALPA contract. Under the leadership of former TWA pilot Jerry Muggerdichen, who would become ALPA secretary in 1990, Midway's pilots now needed office space for their new MEC. Muggerdichen asked his vice chairman, Frank Anthony, to investigate renting office space in the old building across the street from Midway, which neither of them knew had once been ALPA's national office. Anthony recalled that the building was coming down as part of Midway's renovation, so the association couldn't rent office space in it. But while checking out the building, he noticed a brass mail drop with the letters ALPA on it. From this lucky break, everything else flowed. Tom Dalton, director of ALPA's office administration department, vaguely recalled the time capsule, thus setting in motion a recovery effort that would involve the pilots of many airlines. United MEC Communications Director Jim Damron a second-generation airline pilot with a keen interest in ALPA's history, and his assistant, Hank Krakowski, helped with the salvage effort. The time capsule returned to a world in which airline pilots were confronting their history in the most painful way possible, by reliving it. Frank Lorenzo's replication of the actions of E.L. Cord had plunged ALPA into a world of turmoil, bankruptcies, and ruined careers. Despite these trials, ALPA's future was far from hopeless as Hank Duffy began his second term. The rash of deregulation-inspired new entrant airlines seemed, to some observers, to preface a tremendous new diversity of carriers in the industry, much like conditions at the time of ALPA's founding. For every Braniff that failed, an optimist could see a Midway rising to take its place. If the future of the industry was to be one of diversity, ALPA could survive by conducting outreach efforts to educate the pilots of these new airlines. With proper preparation, these non-union pilots would, when the time was right, be brought to see ALPA's advantages. Pessimists predicted that the unfettered free market would eventually result in a semi-monopolistic Big Three airlines dominating a swarm of small, non-union carriers whose pilots worked for peanuts. In their dark vision of the future, it would be either feast or famine for airline pilots, depending upon where they worked, and the ancient ALPA principle of unity across company lines could hardly survive in a world of haves and have-nots. The efforts United's pilots had made to stem the anti-pilot tide in 1985 was, pessimists feared, merely temporary. While the failure of United CEO Dick Ferris to break ALPA seemed to discourage other airline executives from trying it themselves, Frank Lorenzo still lurked out there, undefeated, and he had just acquired control of Eastern Airlines, one of aviation's most prestigious namesakes. Critics warned of Lorenzo's spreading empire, which would eventually include newcomer People Express and the revived Frontier. They cautioned that deregulation would lead to more airline failures. But, at that time, few pessimists foresaw the fates of Eastern and Pan American. History needs a little distance, both in time and emotional involvement, before making firm judgments. Otherwise, history might become indistinguishable from journalism, history's first rough draft. Not that journalism is unimportant. No historian would be able to write about the Eastern strike of 1989 without it. Most of the important contemporary books dealing with Eastern and its fate were written by beat journalists, covering it almost daily as it unfolded. For example, Aaron Bernstein's 1990 book, Grounded, Frank Lorenzo and the Destruction of Eastern Airlines. Bernstein, a reporter for Business Week, covered Eastern from 1985. Which was before Lorenzo took over, until a bankruptcy court judge finally removed him from control in April 1990. When Bernstein finished his book, Eastern was still alive, albeit barely. But history must cover the rest of the story. So what conclusions might we draw about ALPA's history during the late Duffy era? The most obvious generalization might be that the nature of Duffy's power was comparably weaker than that of any previous ALPA president. We can get an inkling of this by comparing him to J.J. O'Donnell, who until 1978 worked in a regulated environment. Before 1978, O'Donnell unhesitatingly took the leaders of errant MECs to task, often aggressively challenging them. As we have seen, in the mid-1970s, O'Donnell repeatedly lambasted the Continental pilots, quite a major group at the time. But after deregulation, confronting a major pilot group like that was unthinkable. Witness O'Donnell's restraint in the case of United's Blue Skies contract in 1981. From the moment Duffy took office in January 1983, his presidency had essentially been reactive, with strategic long-range planning taking a back seat to the kind of tactical, short-range thinking the latest crisis demanded. At the beginning of his second term, with the storm seeming to abate and the internal division symbolized by Tom Ashwood's challenge resolved, Duffy hoped he could devote his full attention to ensuring ALPA's effectiveness in the deregulated airline industry of the future. If ALPA was to survive as the profession's voice into the 1990s and beyond, Duffy knew he would have to move it beyond the petty internal squabbling that had so far characterized the 1980s. But nothing came easily for Hank Duffy. He would have no let-up from the agony of deregulation-induced mergers, with all the internal discord that implied. Nor was Frank Lorenzo finished. After acquiring control of Eastern in early 1986, Lorenzo made promises of peace and cooperation with ALPA and remained relatively quiet throughout the remainder of Duffy's first term. But that was only the lull before the storm. Duffy's trials would continue to the bitter end of his 8-year tenure, culminating in an ALPA presidential election of unparalleled historical disunity. Duffy would not seek a third term. Some pilot groups threatened to leave ALPA over the association's merger policy. Others had similar gripes. Keeping the association required a truly diplomatic effort and a lot of compromise that wasn't, as Duffy described it, too pleasant. Although Duffy's mind was clearly on his place in ALPA's history, his concern for the future was obvious. By the beginning of his second term, deregulation had brought about a set of circumstances within the airline industry that no other ALPA president had faced. If the critics of deregulation were right, and the industry degenerated into a semi-monopoly, what was ALPA's future? The evolution of the industry into a few mammoth airlines could take ALPA into unexplored regions. Could an ALPA president withstand a determined assault by one of these new post-deregulation megacarriers? More to the point, could ALPA itself survive a concerted effort by the leadership of one of these new super airlines to leave the union, as the pilots of American Airlines had done in 1963? To Duffy, keeping ALPA together was the real challenge. With the airline industry increasingly dominated by giant carriers, each supreme in its own sphere of hubs and spokes, many thoughtful observers believed it would only be a matter of time before Duffy's fears materialized. As we shall see, at the end of Duffy's administration, following the bitter and controversial election of Randy Babbitt, that hour seemed to have struck. The pilots of United, against all odds, were clearly disgruntled, bitter about the defeat of Roger Hall. Duffy speculated that the real challenge for his successor would be to make sure that ALPA wouldn't shatter into a loose federation of independent unions. It had been suggested that the association might lure American back into ALPA with promises of autonomy, but in his estimation, that wouldn't be worth the price. The biggest advantage ALPA has is its ability to speak with one voice. The chair of the House Aviation Subcommittee doesn't get the United pilot position whispered in one ear and the Delta position whispered in the other. He hears one position from airline pilots. ALPA is effective in Washington, D.C. for that very reason. Duffy knew that if ALPA ever dissolved into independent organizations, its enemies would have it for lunch. He pondered what the association would look like when members opened that time capsule a century after his time as president. Next time on Flying the Line, as Lorenzo gains control of Eastern Airlines, ALPA President Hank Duffy prepares to take on his greatest challenge. Thank you for listening. This has been Chapter 18, Part 1 of Flying the Line 2 by George E. Hopkins, Copyright 2000. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast. To listen and subscribe to more in this series, please check us out online at alpa.org or find us on all major podcast platforms. Until next time, this is the Flying the Line podcast, a look into the past of the Airline Pilots Association International. Production copyright ALPA 2024, all rights reserved.